Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you.
Ezekiel saw the wheel.
He saw that wheel.
Right in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel.
I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. A new version of an old space race is on again, scanning the heavens for the truth about us. Ezekiel started it in the Hebrew Bible. The prophet who saw a wheel in a wheel way up in the middle of the air. In the Black American spiritual, the big wheel runs by faith. The little wheel runs by the grace of God. Those wheels were the first unidentified flying objects in our culture, representing perhaps this life and eternity. In 21st century science, the question, and it's not just scientific, is how would we get to know what's out there? Who's watching? Who cares? A Pentagon task force is scheduled this month to open a deep file it never before confirmed that it kept. An array of sightings and Navy pilots' videos, shards of alien objects, reports, as they say, from credible observers of relatively incredible things. And we're looking, this radio hour, at one instance of the puzzle. Call the puzzle Oumuamua, the name astronomers gave to an interstellar phenomenon that cruised past our sun at supersonic speed in 2017. Our guest, the Harvard astrophysicist Avi Loeb, made a book of it titled Extraterrestrial, about a visitor like none other, a mystery and a surprise. It was the best evidence yet, Avi Loeb decided, of an extraterrestrial intelligence.
In October 2017, the first object from outside the solar system was spotted in our neighborhood. And we knew that it came from outside because it moved too fast to be bound to the sun. Mm. It was discovered by a telescope in Hawaii called the Pan-STARRS and was given the name Oumuamua, which means scout in the Hawaiian language. Mm. And at first, the astronomers thought, oh, it must be a rock of the type that we have seen before within the solar system, except it came from another star. But as we started to collect data about it, it looked weird. First of all, it didn't have any cometary tail visually. There was no gas around it that reflected sunlight. And moreover, the Spitzer Space Telescope looked very deeply around it and couldn't find any trace of carbon-based molecules. And so that implied that it's definitely not a comet. A comet usually shows gas or dust around it as it evaporates by sunlight. And then as the object was tumbling every 8 hours, the amount of sunlight reflected from it changed by a factor of 10. And that implied a very extreme shape, most likely pancake-like, a flat shape, based on the modeling of the reflected light as it was spinning around. It also exhibited an excess push away from the sun, in addition to the force of gravity that acted on it. And this push declined inversely with distance squared. And since there was no gas evaporating from it, there was no rocket effect, the only explanation that came to my mind was that it's the sunlight reflected off the surface of this object that is giving it the push. Hmm. And for that to be effective, you needed the object to be very thin, sort of like a sail, yep, except not being pushed by the wind, as you find in sailboats, but here being pushed by reflecting sunlight. Nature doesn't make light sails. We are producing them artificially for space exploration. And it turns out that in September 2020, there was another object discovered that exhibited an excess push away from the sun by reflecting sunlight without a cometary tail. And it was given the name 2020 SO, discovered by the same telescope. And the astronomers, shortly after the discovery, realized, oh, it's actually rocket booster from a mission to the moon that was launched in 1966. And we know that this rocket booster had very thin walls and therefore had a large surface area for its mass. And that's why it was pushed by reflecting sunlight. and it didn't show any cometary tail. So we know that we produced 2020 SO artificially. The question is, who produced Oumuamua?
Could I ask, why did you call it intelligent?
Well, I just make the distinction between a naturally produced object and an artificially produced object by some technological civilization. And after my paper was published, over the past 4 years, there were four suggestions made by other scientists to explain Oumuamua, all the peculiar features of it, through a natural origin. Hmm. One suggested that it's a hydrogen iceberg, chunk of frozen hydrogen, so that when it evaporates, we can't see the cometary tail because hydrogen is transparent. And the problem with that is that hydrogen evaporates very quickly, so such a chunk the size of a football field would not survive the journey through interstellar space. And then there was a suggestion, maybe it's a nitrogen iceberg chipped off the surface of a planet like Pluto around another star. And here the problem is the mass budget. You just don't have enough material in all the Pluto-like planets around other stars to explain a large enough abundance of objects such that we will discover one of them as Oumuamua. And then there was a suggestion, maybe it's a cloud of dust particles, sort of like a dust bunny that you find at home. And the problem with that, if it's 100 times less dense than air, so that it can be pushed by reflecting sunlight, then it would also not have the material strength to withstand the heating by the sun to hundreds of degrees. And then there was a suggestion, maybe it's a fragment of a bigger object that happened to pass close to a star and was tidally disrupted. And the problem with that idea is that most of the fragments usually have an elongated shape, cigar shape, not a pancake shape, the way we inferred for Oumuamua. So altogether, my point is quite simple. If we have to contemplate something that we've never seen before, we should definitely leave on the table the possibility that it's of artificial origin. The experience is similar to walking on the beach. Most of the time you see rocks or seashells that were naturally produced, but every now and then you see a plastic bottle. And that tells you that there is a civilization out there.
You call it evidence of intelligence. Who or what might be the designing mind or agent behind such a thing?
So most of the stars formed billions of years before the sun. About half of the sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly the same separation. And so my basic premise is, if you arrange for similar circumstances to those that we find on Earth, you get similar outcomes. And therefore, there must have been a lot of technological civilizations like us billions of years ago. Yes. And they launched equipment into space, like we are launching spacecraft like Voyager 1, Voyager 2, New Horizons, that will exit the solar system ultimately. So space could be filled with equipment, and most of it will be non-operational, because just imagine Voyager a billion years from now. So most of the equipment will be very old, not operational, just floating through space, and we will encounter it. Now, of course, the best way to tell the difference between an artificial object and a natural object is by taking a close-up photograph. And we can do that if we get an alert of the next object that is approaching us, and we could send, for example, a spacecraft equipped with a camera that will intercept its trajectory. You know, we can imagine a similar mission to a future interstellar object that looks as weird as Oumuamua. And just imagine landing on an object that looks artificial and reading off the label, made on planet X, and importing the technology that we find there to Earth. It could be worth a lot of money because it represents something from our future. You know, it's just like putting your hands on a cell phone that is not yet released to the public and has very fancy features. It should be very exciting.
Yeah, and some deep level, you can hear millions, maybe billions of people saying, thank you, Professor Loeb, but we knew it all along. We're not alone. It's an ancient hope or thought or fear, maybe, that they're out there.
Yeah, that's the general perception that the public has, and I very much resonate with it. Unfortunately, the surprising thing is that the scientific community is pushing back, is very much opposed to discussing openly possible signatures of extraterrestrial technologies.
Why is that deep down? Is it about science? Is it about humility? Is it about fear?
All of the above. Basically, scientists prefer to stay in their comfort zone. There was a colloquium about Oumuamua at Harvard, and when I left the auditorium, a colleague of mine that worked on rocks throughout his career said, Oumuamua is so strange, I wish it never existed. That illustrates that instead of embracing anomalies, because, you know, anomalies are the way of nature telling us there is something new you need to learn. You know, science is a learning experience. We should welcome anomalies rather than ridicule them, rather than reject them, rather than try to argue that business should be practiced as usual. You know, and often what you hear from scientists is that they need extraordinary evidence to be moved away from their comfort zone. But the problem is when they are not providing funds, for example, for the search for extraterrestrial technologies, and at the same time they're claiming there is no extraordinary evidence, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just like stepping on the grass and claiming, look, the grass doesn't grow. And unfortunately, it maintains our ignorance. It's just like the philosophers that refused to look through Galileo's telescope because they knew that the sun moves around the earth. But the fact that they didn't look through the telescope maintained their ignorance. It didn't really change anything about reality. You know, the earth continued to move around the sun. And the same is true about searching for intelligence out there. You know, we may have neighbors that are smarter than us. And if we don't look through the window, it doesn't change the fact that they exist. So just believing that we know the answer without checking, not funding the search, you know, we are searching, for example, for the nature of dark matter, which makes most of the matter in the universe. And we invested hundreds of millions of dollars in that and we didn't find anything. But that's not a problem according to the mainstream because, you know, this search is legitimate. Let's search in the dark. My point is, that search will have little influence on the daily lives of people. The search for technological signatures will have a huge impact on society. So how can we have a situation where the search for technological relics is not funded at a level that is 1,000 times less than the search for dark matter? The public is interested and the public funds science.
Coming up, still a contest. What's really real out there? This is Open Source. Our guest, Avi Loeb, is not the first Harvard scientist to feel the risky lure of the extraterrestrial. 25 years ago, the psychiatrist John Mack was put on trial by colleagues at the Harvard Medical School for insisting that attention must be paid to his patients who described being abducted by aliens. John Mack made his case to Oprah Winfrey and to me on our radio show, The Connection. And he kept his job.
What I began to have to deal with is people of sound mind telling a consistent story with appropriate intense emotion. This isn't the emotion of an experimental planted idea. Full of doubt themselves because it conflicts with their view of the world as much as it does with ours. And they say, look, you won't believe this, doctor, but around my bed were these beings with these big black eyes and they're terrified as they describe this. And they worry that they're crazy. But psychological tests over and over again show that these are people of sound mind, normal psychologically. Not that there can't be people in that group that also have troubles, but there is nothing psychiatric we've been able to find that distinguishes them from anybody else.
Professor Loeb, how risky professionally is it in your profession to stick your neck out and say, no, that's evidence? I mean, it was risky for Galileo. It was risky for John Mack, psychiatrist, who wanted to listen carefully to people who felt they'd been abducted by aliens. That's 25 years ago at Harvard, your institution. What is the price today for taking your position?
Well, so I take my position based on my experience throughout my career. I had a number of occasions where I promoted the new frontier, and it was initially ridiculed and people didn't really subscribe to the notion. And then after some years, often a decade or two, it became part of the mainstream. And then the young people that enter those fields now, they say, oh, of course, you know, I cannot believe that people did not support these frontiers in the past. And those that objected to those frontiers of research, they are saying, yeah, of course, this sounds like the right thing to do now. But back then, they were very much ridiculing the subject. And I have a number of such examples. So that makes me a little more immune to this criticism. Mm. And also, I have tenure. So, you know, that's the purpose of tenure, to allow you job security and the confidence that you can advocate for what seems to be right, even if there is a crowd around you saying something else. And frankly, I don't care about how many likes I have on Twitter. And that is based on, if you look at the history of human thought, you know, you go back to Socrates. He argued for questioning authority and questioning public figures and so forth, and advocated a dialogue for figuring out the truth. And he was blamed by the Athenian society that was a city-state.
And he paid a price.
Yeah, so he was blamed for corrupting the youth and was put in jail and forced to drink poison. And the analog today is that he would be cancelled on the Athenian social media. So the equivalent of poison is, you know, that on social media, people will ridicule you and say, attack you personally. That's the current approach that would have been taken towards Socrates. Now, with respect to Galileo, you know, he was put in house arrest and so that he will not have any public influence. And, you know, I was put in house arrest over the past year, but it was because of the pandemic, not because of my colleagues. So I don't really care about that. So frankly, you know, I think what I think about is not me personally. And of course, you know, I get bruised by this experience. But I think more about humanity. You know, I think it's an important subject for our future because it will change our perspective about our place in the universe, our aspirations for space. And that's more important than my personal fate. And that gives me, you know, the conviction to maintain the course and bring it to the mainstream of science so that scientists will address this subject as it should be addressed.
Could I ask, how much of the fear is that whoever they are out there want to invade us someday? I'm in love with Dostoevsky's version, just the opposite, which was that the life out there in planets like ours is in fact a kind of heaven, a great example to us. He has a wonderful story in which a space traveler captured by aliens found a great new lesson about what life could be on Earth.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it really depends on your perspective about life. If you look at what happened when the European expeditions arrived to the Americas, then you might be a pessimist because the indigenous people did not enjoy that experience of meeting invaders. And so, you know, as a general principle, when you go in the wilderness, you better be quiet and not speak out because you never know whether there are predators out there. Hmm. Unfortunately, we have been broadcasting for more than a century radio waves. And if there is any civilization that has radio telescopes of the type that we have within 100 light years from us, then they already know about us. Now, if they are attempting to get back to us using chemical rockets, it would take them a million years, so we still have time. But on the other hand, if they have means of propulsion that are much faster, you know, they could get back to us much sooner. And I think we don't really know whether they're peaceful or whether they are predators, and we should be careful about it. And presumably, if they already know about us and haven't yet reached us, we just have to monitor the sky. The worst thing we can do is to basically ignore the possibility that they exist.
Speak in general to the public that hungers for, among other things, alternative consciousness about ourselves and how we're living. What should people hope is the next piece of evidence coming our way?
Right. So, you know, we are born into this world like actors put on a stage. without knowing what the play is about. First thing to do is, as an astronomer, you know, to look at the stage, and after, you know, studying it, it looks like it's huge. It's 10 to the power 26 times bigger than our body. That's the size of the observable universe. And moreover, it looks like the play took place for 13.8 billion years. And we just came towards the end. So my conclusion from that is that we are certainly not the main players, the main actors in that play, as people often think. They think the play is about us. You know, the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle argued that we are at the center of the universe. That doesn't make much sense given what we know now. I can understand that because my daughters, when they were young, tended to think that they are the center of the world, that they are the smartest. And that perception changed when they went to the kindergarten, obviously, and met other kids. So, of course, for us to mature, we have to meet others. My point is that if we meet others, perhaps, you know, they existed for a longer period, so they figured out what the play is about. Perhaps they will give us a better sense of the meaning of life, of what, you know, everything we see around us, this scenery, this stage that we find. Maybe they will make more sense of it for us.
Which takes us back to the incredible excitement I associate with Bud Hopkins. He's an artist, but an early believer in UFOs. He said, if alien intelligence is real and out there, it's the biggest event, the biggest story of human history.
Yes, I agree with that.
Oh.
And that is another reason why, you know, I maintain my course, because the implications are huge. And in my book, Extraterrestrial, I talk about Oumuamua's wager, which is basically similar to the wager posed
Pascal.
By Blaise Pascal. He said,
yes,
about God, he said, you know, as a mathematician, he said there are two possibilities. Either God exists or God doesn't exist. But if God exists, then the implications are huge, and therefore we cannot dismiss that possibility. And so the same is true for Oumuamua being a technological relic. You know, if it is a technological relic, the implications are huge, and therefore we should collect more data about objects that look like it in the future. And my point is, unfortunately, the mainstream of the science community right now ridicules this subject, dismisses the possibility, and, you know, it's basically putting blinders on our eyes, not trying to check whether there are plastic bottles out there among all the rocks that we see. And I find that to be frustrating, because I do think that this is the biggest question we can address as scientists. So how can we shy away from it? How can we ridicule it in that way? I think it's just unhealthy, inappropriate for science to do it. You know, it resembles, if you go back 1,000 years, there were people arguing that the human body has a soul and therefore anatomy should be forbidden. Just imagine if scientists were saying, oh, this subject is controversial. There are all kinds of beliefs about the human body. We don't want to study the human body. Where would modern medicine be if that were the case? So I think scientists have an obligation to study a subject of interest to the public using the scientific method, using the best instruments we have, and clear it up rather than shy away from it and say, oh, that's controversial. We don't want to deal with it.
You say clear it up. Can you imagine it being cleared up in your lifetime?
Yeah, I can. If enough resources will be allocated, I can definitely imagine it during my lifetime, and I will be glad to be involved in that finding, you know. And I should say there is also something we should wait for in the coming weeks, and that is the report coming from the Pentagon and intelligence agencies that should be delivered to Congress about some unidentified aerial phenomena. Let's see what that report says, because apparently there are some high-level officials, former officials, including President Barack Obama and, you know, the director of the CIA, James Woolsey, and the director of intelligence, Ratcliffe, and others, claiming that these objects appear to be real, that there seem to be some evidence, but they don't know their nature. And you know, that's intriguing enough for us to try and collect more data about them. It's obviously a matter of national security, but beyond that, if it looks like something really unusual, then it could be related to the science we were discussing before.
Yeah, you say it could be a security threat. It could also be just plain embarrassing to discover that we are not the center of anything, maybe. And our way of life, even our thinking, is not the last chapter in the book. I'm thinking also of the difficulties of our friend John Mack 25 years ago as a psychiatrist wanting to probe. He was really put on trial in his medical school faculty and forced to justify even his job. Where are those forces coming from in the wider world, you think? And what's the chance they could snuff this out?
Well, I do think that the physical sciences, rather than you know, the psychology or humanities, are quite different in the sense that they are based on direct and undisputable empirical evidence that can be reproduced. And for example, just to give you an example, if we get a photograph of an object in space and it looks nothing like a rock, it does look like an artificial piece of equipment, I don't think there is any reasonable person who would argue otherwise, who would say, no, it's actually a rock. Because otherwise, that person would appear to be just like a caveman that is presented with a cell phone and claiming it's just a shiny rock. So I do think that in the physical sciences, you know, in difference from psychology, where you can argue both ways, in the physical sciences, there is a sense of experimental evidence that cannot be disputed. And that's what allows physics to make progress and technology to eventually harness what we understand about nature. And I do think that we can break the ice in that context, but we do need to search for that experimental evidence. The problem, as I see it, is the psychology puts a barrier, because scientists say, it's all rocks, you know, it's never aliens, it's never technology. So if you're not searching for wonderful things, you will never find them. So my point is, if we were to allow ourselves to discover new things, then we will find them, and then it will be undisputable.
That's what makes Dostoevsky's story so moving to me. He didn't know what to expect, but he found grace. He found happiness beyond science, not understanding happiness, but being happy and living it in all our relations. That there's a great gift coming in that discovery from a human standpoint.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, Dostoevsky is one of my favorite writers. Yes.
Ah, and mine. That story, The Dream of a Ridiculous Man, I say it's all of Dostoevsky in 20 pages, and anybody can get it. I have to ask you the Fermi question. Fermi, during World War II, in the Manhattan Project, he was known for asking over lunch, just informal chat, what about other life, other places? And he said, given what we knew then, it was a fragment of what we know now about the billions and billions of places where life could rise and develop. He said the answer to the question is really that, of course, there's been other life out there, but there is something in the nature of growth, development, complexity, technology that serves an impulse to destroy as well as to grow. And he said there were other civilizations, but they destroyed themselves. A caution that people think about hard these days, global warming and other threats to the whole show. What is the answer to the Fermi question?
Yeah, so first I should say, indeed, it's quite likely that technological civilizations are short-lived, because if you look at world politics today, we're not taking good care of our planet. We might not survive for more than a few centuries from now. And that's a small window of time relative to the age of the Earth. So if civilizations like ours maintain communication just for such a short window of time, then that would explain why we don't see many of them when we search for radio signals. Mm. But my point is that if we search for relics that they left behind, that's similar to archaeology. And there you are not limited to requiring that the civilization is alive when you are searching for it. You can find the relics that it left behind in the form of equipment floating in space. So that's a much better approach to search for dead civilizations. But in terms of why we don't see them, I would argue that Fermi's question is pretentious, because when I met my wife, you know, she had a lot of friends that were waiting for Prince Charming on a white horse that will show up and make them a marriage proposal. And it never happened, so they had to compromise. And my point is that why do we feel that we are sufficiently special and interesting for aliens to come to our backyard and have a party? I don't think so. I think that things like us existed for billions of years, and we are just like ants on a sidewalk. When you walk down the street, you don't pay special attention to each and every ant. And therefore, you know, we shouldn't expect them to show interest in us. And we actually developed our technologies only over the past century. So, you know, we were not that interesting before. We were quite boring, indistinguishable from animals. So I'm not at all surprised that we don't see them at our doorstep. And the other thing that I came across during the pandemic is the idea of social distancing on a cosmic scale. Basically, you can imagine very advanced civilizations deciding to close themselves off in a cocoon because they don't want to lower their quality of life by communicating with lesser civilizations. So that doesn't mean that we will never find out anything about them, because they still need to throw out their trash. And just like investigative journalists that go after the trash cans of celebrities in Hollywood, we could find out about their private lives by finding their space trash.
Coming up, Dostoevsky's take from 150 years ago on the reality to be learned from aliens. This is Open Source. Pushing our guest Avi Loeb on the religious implications of a universe teeming with life and creatures, perhaps minds, even souls, as impressive as ours. And you touch on there, we would be considerably reduced, shall we say, to discover that we are ants, basically, in the bigger picture. At the same time, Galileo felt in the end that what he learned about the galaxy and the solar system was not a threat to his biblical understanding, a compatible message in a different language. What is required of us in this search to think anew about our reverence for this world as well as our systems of belief?
Right. Well, many religions were based historically on the notion that humans are really special and they are the focus of attention of God. For example, if you go back a few centuries, there is the case of Giordano Bruno that a lot of people didn't like at the time because he was quite abrasive. But he also made the argument that other stars may be just like the sun, and therefore they could have a planet just like the Earth, and therefore there could be life on those many planets out there. And the church at the time found it to be offensive because they said, well, if there is life on other planets around other stars, then if that form of life sinned, you need the Christ to visit those planets and save the life from the sins that were committed. And then you need a lot of copies of Christ, you know, billions of copies visiting all these planets out there. And the church said, well, that's ridiculous. And they burned him on a stake. You know, they basically burned the guy because right. He claimed that. Now, many of the things he said, you know, based on our current scientific knowledge, are correct. You know, that other stars are similar to the sun and that they have planets similar to the Earth. And perhaps there is life on those. What I would say is that when I speak to religious people now, both Christians or Jews, or any other religion, they say that they can adapt to the notion that there are other intelligent creatures out there. They don't see that as a threat to their religious belief. So I would say that now it seems like people will adapt to that. Hmm. And of course, to me, I can give you my general perspective. I don't see a contradiction between the study of the universe and religion, as long as religion doesn't try to make predictions about the physical universe. And I'll explain that with an analogy.
Yeah, please.
You just see a beautiful building, you know, and the universe is beautiful. You know, it's organized by the laws of physics that we find here on Earth, everywhere. And what the physicists are trying to do, what the scientists, the cosmologists are trying to do, is figure out the building blocks that make up the universe and so forth. It's just like figuring out the bricks that make up the building and how they were put together. But that doesn't say anything about the blueprint of why this building is beautiful, you know. And the way I see that is as metaphysics, or you can associate it with religion. You know, anything that goes beyond appreciating how the universe works, it could be part of religion or metaphysics. So there is no contradiction. The physicists will never go that direction, and they just explain the machinery. So they are sort of like the people that appreciate how the building is constructed, but they would not deal with the blueprint. You know, what makes that building beautiful? And so that could be the realm of religion, as long as it doesn't try to explain what the building is made of and how it was constructed, because that's the part that physics is attempting to do. So I don't see a contradiction. And of course, that includes also whatever is in the building, you know, like if there is life on planets around other stars, you know, that's part of the universe. We have to accept that. And by accepting the richness of the universe, we can appreciate better. You know, even if you are a religious person, you can appreciate better what was created, because you appreciate the richness of it. You know, it's just like looking at a watch, you know, from a distance, you might say, oh, I can see the time, and that's pretty much it. But if you open up the watch and look at all the details of how it works, then you get a much better appreciation of the watch, of the amazing technology that is in it. The same way you can think about the universe and let's study everything in it, and then we will get a better appreciation, even if you are a religious person.
That matches Galileo's outlook, as I understand it. But let me ask, who are your favorite fellow travelers out there in this search? I'm thinking not just astronomers, imaginative people, historical people. Who are the people you're traveling with?
Oh, I'm traveling with those people that presented notions that we now embrace over history, over human history, that were very much ridiculed, rejected, bullied during their time. These are people, as I mentioned, like Socrates, like Epicurus. If you just study Epicurus, I mean, I did it during the pandemic. It's quite amazing. You know, he advocated for atoms making matter. He advocated that after death, there is nothing left. He advocated for a lot of ideas that are now embraced by, you know, our culture, by a lot of people now. And he did it a long time ago, so that's quite remarkable. And he was rejected during his time. And then there is Galileo, of course, and you also have recent examples of ideas that were proposed, rejected, and people were not appreciated during their time. It also happens in the arts. If you look at Vincent van Gogh, for example, he was considered a madman during his time, and then the Expressionists adapted his painting style, and he became extremely popular. Now his paintings are worth the most amount of money in sales. And so I get the sense that when you are advocating for something meaningful that is ahead of its time, you often get this pushback and backlash. And the question is, what matters to you personally? If what matters to you is the recognition, the prizes, the awards, the warm feeling that you might get from people liking you on Twitter, then you don't go that path. But, you know, just like Robert Frost in the famous poem, there were two paths in the woods, and I took the one that was less traveled by, and that made all the difference. And I don't regret that for a minute.
Neither do we, if I may say. You mentioned a name and I didn't get it. You're saying
Epicurus.
Epicurus, yes, of course.
No, so one thing he said that I really like is the idea that you don't have to worry about death. Most people worry about the time that they will die. And he argued you don't need to worry about it because he was not worried about it because as long as he is alive, death is not around. And whenever death will come, he will not be around, so he will never meet death, and therefore he should not be worried about it. You only worry about things that you meet.
Speak about the danger that we all feel we're in. I'm thinking Martin Rees, the famous royal astronomer in England, has said, in effect, this planet has been around for 75 million centuries, and there's a real chance that we're living in the last one. He's got a bet with Steve Pinker, it turns out. He says there will be a man-made accident that will take a million lives. And Steve, just on the score of COVID-19, will have a big payoff to Martin Rees as things stand. He's worried about it. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think it's not a good approach to be a pessimist and to always forecast a gloomy future. I do believe in the human spirit. I'm an optimist. And fundamentally, I think that many things that happen to us in life are a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you are a pessimist, you know, and you are forecasting a gloomy future, it might actually happen. But if you are an optimist, you can evade that gloomy future. And I believe that we can be the outlier on the statistical distribution of possible outcomes, you know, if we are striving for a better future. So I would much rather adopt a positive point of view where I say, let's find ways to make our future better. And, you know, one reason I'm searching for intelligence in space is because I don't often find it here on Earth. And if you look at human history, we often waste a lot of resources in fighting each other and in trying to feel superior relative to each other. Actually, the latter tendency is the source of all evil in human history because it leads to racism, anti-Semitism, supremacism, wars, genocide. So there is this example of Winston Churchill that in 1939 he wrote an essay saying, let's search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It should be a very exciting search. And he didn't have a chance to publish this essay because he was drafted to become the Prime Minister of the UK in fighting the Nazis during the Second World War. And just think about the Second World War. It wasted $4 trillion just for the US economy and killed 75 million people, which is 3% of the world population at that time, including 6 million Jews. That was a genocide by the Germans. That was 2/3 of the Jewish community in Europe at the time. And just think about an alternate history where the same resources and lives would have been dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the original vision of Winston Churchill. So instead of him becoming a legendary politician, he would have become a thought leader. You just think about the alternative history. We could have known by now the answer to the question, are we alone? Are we the smartest kid on the block? So to me, this illustrates the reminder that we are not very smart. We are not intelligent. And perhaps that's why other civilizations do not accept us yet to the club of intelligent civilizations within the Milky Way galaxy, because we haven't yet demonstrated that we are intelligent enough. And the way I define an intelligent civilization is a civilization that is based on cooperation and the sharing of evidence-based knowledge, which are the principles of science, if you think about it. Science is based on cooperation and sharing of evidence-based knowledge. And if our civilization will embrace the principles of science, I think it will be heading to a much better future. Not the type of future that Martin Rees is forecasting, but a bright future in which we will survive for a long time. And rather than say, oh, we are doomed, I would say, let's work together. Let's cooperate towards a better future. Let's adapt the principles of science and and we can all survive for a long time.
Avi Loeb, you spoke with conviction earlier on the point that you will see some clear resolution of these extraterrestrial intelligence questions in your lifetime. Let's give you 40, 50 years. What will the story be when it happens?
Well, it really depends on how much we invest in the search. But I do believe that if we invest similar amounts of money in the search for technological signatures as we currently invest, for example, in the search for dark matter or in the search for gravitational waves with the LIGO experiment, that was $1.1 billion, the price tag that the National Science Foundation funded. If we invest similar amounts of money in the search for those technological signatures, I think we have a very good chance that within the coming decades, we'll see something.
Yeah, but tell us the story of what we'll see.
I think most likely it would be a piece of technology that we find, because creatures, you know, biological entities, have a difficult time traveling through space, through the huge distances, because it takes a long time for the journey. And I think pieces of equipment can survive easily the trip. So most likely we will find evidence for technological equipment. Now, it could be in the form of relics, you know, like Oumuamua, objects that fly by. It could be in the form of industrial pollution on the atmospheres of other planets. Or it could be in the form of, you know, some debris that we find on the moon, or in the form of a meteor that we discover on Earth. But it would be something like that. And, of course, you know, at the same time, we can search for signatures of microbes, for example, on Mars or in the gases that make up the atmospheres of other planets. But I'm less excited about that. I don't really care about microbes. I really care about learning something new from an intelligent species out there. And the very least you can learn is if, for example, it's something left behind by a dead civilization that killed itself as a result of misbehaving or climate change or fighting a war, then we can get a historical lesson and get our act together and perhaps avoid a similar fate. So I do think that it serves a very important purpose of guiding us into our future. And I very much hope that in my lifetime, we will get that lesson.
And what will the, shall we say, the New York Times lead sentence be on what we learned in your lifetime? How will that sentence read?
An artificial piece of equipment was discovered, you know, in orbit near the sun, something of that type. I'm not sure exactly where and what type of equipment, but I do believe that could be the case. And of course, it's not just the headline of one New York Times daily report. I think it will change human history forever, and it will be discussed in many books and in many stories for years to come. It will be a milestone, a major milestone in human history to figure out that we are not the smartest kid on the block, that there are other kids out there. And it will provide a psychological shock similar to the one that was encountered by my daughters when they went to the kindergarten on their first day.
Mm. You're sounding more and more like your friend Dostoevsky. There's good news out there. There are good people out there.
Oh, yeah. I'm optimistic, as I said before. And I do believe that our future is a self-fulfilling prophecy, that if we are optimistic, it will be a good future.
We're following you. And you're also very, very generous with your time and your learning. Avi Loeb, thank you very much for this conversation.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks for hosting me.
Fyodor Dostoevsky gets our last word this hour from his alien abduction story titled The Dream of a Ridiculous Man, published in 1877. The ridiculous man turns out to be a lonely loser in Petersburg, a man underground, in despair of finding any meaning in life, to the point that he buys a revolver and sets a date to blow his brains out. At the moment of truth, he falls asleep in his apartment and dreams that he's been transported to what looks like a sunny Greek island on a planet much like ours. Its people are not learned or scientific, but they're loving, serene, frolicsome, thoughtfully ecstatic. When Dostoevsky's man wakes at home, he realizes it may have been a dream, but it cannot be that it did not take place. So he will preach his liberating experience for the rest of his life on street corners. And when people tease him, saying, "It was just a dream," he answers, "Your reality made me want to kill myself. My dream revealed to me a great, new, regenerated intensity of life. The chief thing he's come to realize is to love others as oneself. The old golden rule. It could transform the world in an hour, he says, if people applied it. So in his rapture, he will go on teaching it. Credit and thanks to the great Dostoevsky and to our guest Avi Loeb, the astrophysicist who wrote the book, Extraterrestrial. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath keeps her eyes on our skies. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of independent podcasts making some of the smartest audio you can find. This week, check out The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. On the latest episode, host Mark Chrysler looks at humanity's many attempts to determine the age of the Earth, from biblical genealogy to bitter scientific rivalry. Listen at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.